All right, let's go ahead and open up to Matthew 26. I promised the Thursday night group that we would be through chapter 26, so I better stick to that. So let's go ahead and get going here. I guess we could put our map up again. We've just left. We were at the Last Supper. Most people pinpoint that down here somewhere. They've gone up the Kidron Valley. We just spent some time in the Garden of Gethsemane. There we saw the disciples not watching and falling asleep. And so they weren't strengthened by prayer. They were weakened, and they're going to fall into temptation. And that's going to be half of what we see today. But then we also saw the Lord Jesus Christ, the faithful witness. He went to the same garden. He watched. He prayed. He was strengthened. They all had sorrow. It said Jesus had exceeding sorrow, but he came out of the garden strengthened. The 12 had, well, of course, it was 11 at this time, had exceeding sorrow as well, and they left the garden weakened. It's all a matter of what you do with God and his word. If you replace God's word with your own word, if you take Jesus' words and replace them with the things of men, if you savor the things of men rather than the things of God, all human plans, this is the last half of Romans 1, Paul tells us this explicitly, all human plans apart from God are vanity. They're emptiness. They're nothing. They're all going to come to ruin. You ever read a book called Ecclesiastes? That's what he's bemoaning there. Everything apart from God is ruin. And that's what Peter and the 11 at this point are coming to the garden, and it looks to them like everything's falling apart, everything's coming to ruin, and they're despairing and they're defeated. When if they'd listened to Jesus' words, if they had not savored the things of men but the things of God, they would have realized this cross isn't something to despair over. It's something full of hope. And this, because this is going to end 3 days later in the resurrection, it's going to be proven not to be a defeat. It's going to be a victory. And having ruled that explanation out of their thinking, having rejected that, they're now in the garden. They spiritual slumber that leads to physical, mental, emotional exhaustion. They fall asleep, they're weakened, and they're going to fall into temptation. Jesus goes into that same garden with that same sorrow, except infinitely more, and he comes out strengthened. And that's where we're going to pick it up now. Now he comes in here, and notice when we ended at the Garden of Gethsemane, nobody takes Jesus, right? I hope if you don't know anything else about this garden scene, it's that Jesus surrenders. He gives himself over. He's got to be on that cross in a few hours. He's going to that cross. It's the Father's will. He just verified it through his prayer and the angelic messenger. He's got to be on that cross. He gives himself up. In Matthew, he says, I could call 72,000 angels down here and wipe all you people out. Wipe out not just this puny little mob, but all the temple police, and I could wipe out the whole Roman army. Don't you understand that, Peter? And in John, he puts it a little differently. He says, I am. And he blows them all backwards and they fall. Like lifts them up off the ground and throws them backwards. He surrenders. And of course, it's this surrender that is also the final straw in the disciples' understanding. His surrender is what, I guess we could say, the final straw on the camel's back. It breaks Peter and the 11. They now enter into despair, and we leave the garden. Now look at verse 56 in Matthew 26. He says, but all this was done that the scriptures of the prophets might be fulfilled. Jesus is in full control here. He surrenders. He's not taken by force. He could have changed the whole situation, but in order to fulfill the words of the Father, the scriptures, he's carrying through with this. Then all the disciples, it doesn't say they just fled, like they were fearful of the mob. It says here, they forsook him. They deserted him. they're already beginning to deny him here. They really denied him when they fell asleep at the beginning of the Garden of Gethsemane scene. They've already left him at that point. Physically, they're still there, but mentally and spiritually, they've already deserted him. And they desert him now. When he surrenders, all they see is the total falling apart of their plans and purposes. But to Jesus, it was the fulfilling of God's plan and purpose. Totally different perspective. Whenever, and here we have an interdispensational truth, whenever we replace God's plan and purpose with our own plan and purpose, we're going to end up like Peter and the 11. One day it's all going to fall apart. The key, most of historic Christianity, I was talked to several people. One was part of a Nazarene group, and she said the reason she got saved was because then God, it was the way she got God involved in her things. But you see, that's just religious, superstitious nonsense. Just as Peter saw here, Peter's like, no, Jesus, there is a better way than your way. We don't have to go to that cross. We don't have to suffer. We don't have to do any of that. We can go grab your sword, call down your angelic armies, and let's just get rid of them. Let's get the kingdom that way. That's exactly what we do today. When we deny Pauline grace mystery truth, we say, God, your plan isn't good enough today. I've got a better plan. And we think getting saved is our way to get God involved in our things. Well, I got news for you, everybody. Getting saved is God's way to get you involved in his things. Any other option is going to result in disaster, like we see here with Peter and the 12. And they're going to leave now their plan that they tried to get Jesus and God to follow. How many times do we demand God or pray to God and say, do this God, do that God, do... He's not going to do it. The key is we get involved in his plan. Peter says, God, Jesus, there's a better way. We don't need to go to the cross. We'll get it a different way. Let's get it in power and glory. And Jesus says, no, the way of the Father, the plan of the Father is better. I'm going that way. And that's what we should be doing too. Our goal isn't to get God involved in our things. The goal is that we make our things, that we make his things our things, that he involves us in his things. And if you don't see the difference between those two whole opposite viewpoints on life, then that might be something worth studying further. But we're going to keep going here. He's going to go next now. He's going to leave the Garden of Gethsemane, and they're going to take him to, in Matthew, he goes right to Caiaphas. In the other accounts, we realize first he actually goes to Annas. Annas was the chief priest, the high priest previously, so he's like, I guess, a retired high priest, and they must take him to him first to kind of set the groundwork, get everything in place, get things rolling. And then Annas, who's the retired high priest, is going to send him to Caiaphas, who is his son-in-law, who is the current high priest. And that's where Matthew picks it up. So that's where we'll pick it up too. And then we're going to see this whole account now through the rest of Matthew 26, where he is going to now be before Caiaphas. All right, so if we kind of look at this in a way as a structure, till the end of the chapter, he's going to talk about these illegal trials before the Jewish council. That's going to be the Sanhedrin, the religious leaders, the scribes, the elders of the people. And Peter is going to, and it's encapsulated by Peter entering into the courtyard of the high priest. And the account's going to end with Peter exiting the courtyard of the high priest. Everything left that we're going to talk about today happens in the context of Peter and what Peter's doing. Peter's going to enter into the courtyard. And just a little background there, we're not going to go to all the other accounts, but the way that works is that evidently the Apostle John, that's who we believe it is, In the other accounts, he actually knows the high priest, Caiaphas. So he's allowed into the palace of the high priest. Peter follows from afar and is at the outer door of the palace. And John sees him down there, and he gets Peter into the courtyard. So that's kind of the background that you find out from the other accounts. And that's where we'll pick it up now. Let's read verse 57. I guess just to finish our structure here, so this, the rest of chapter 26 of the illegal trials before the Jewish council encapsulated with Peter going into the courtyard of the high priest and then exiting the courtyard of the high priest. And then chapter 27, he's going to be handed over to Gentile Pilate ruler, and it's going to end with Pilate handing him over to be crucified. All right. So let's go ahead and pick it up in our account here as we finish off chapter 26. So now they verse 57, and they that had laid hold on Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled. So they've all gotten together. They've got this thing all set up. This probably isn't an official trial at this point. This is probably kind of a setup trial. They're going to try and get, we're going to see, they're going to try and gather some evidence so that they can present that evidence for the real trial before Pilate. And so they're all here. They're ready. Remember, we read earlier with the Garden of Gethsemane, these are the ones that sent the temple police, the Roman guards, and the mob out to get Jesus. And now they're here. They're all assembled, and they're going to interview him. Verse 58, and here's the context that it happens in. Here we have Peter. And we won't hear about Peter for a few verses, but here Peter followed him afar off unto the high priest's palace and went in and sat with the servants. And these to me are some of the very sad words at the end here. He went in the servants, sat down, and to see what the end would be. And believe me, Peter does not think there's anything going to be good come out of this end, because he's discarded what Jesus said, replaced it with his own. And he goes in, and he's just, you know what he's doing? He's going in there, he pulls up a chair, and he's just waiting for the train wreck. It's all coming down. Peter's world is tumbling. It's all crashing down. And we'll see where it ends with Peter at the end of this account. But we're going to leave him in the courtyard now, and we're going to look at some of these other things. So between... this is sometime between 12 and 6 a.m. In the night there. Jesus taken to Caiaphas, but his death, of course, is foreknown, is foredetermined. Look at verse 59. Now the chief priests and elders and all the council sought false witness against Jesus to put him to death. Notice they didn't seek witnesses to put him to death. They sought false witnesses. They knew they didn't have any true witnesses. So they were even willing to deal with false witnesses if they could kind of, they were just opaque enough to get away with it. And it's just the hypocrisy here. We're going to see this several times as we go through this account. Their claim to be adhering to the law. The law says you need two or three witnesses to agree in order to condemn someone, especially to death. And so they're like, well, we're obeying the law. But they're not obeying the law, right? They don't care about the law. The law doesn't say find two or three witnesses, whether they're telling the truth or not. It says find two or three truthful witnesses before you can condemn someone. They're looking for any witnesses at all. They don't care if it's the truth or the false. And they know it's going to be false because they don't have anything on them. So there's just a bunch of hypocrites. They claim to be adhering to the law, when in fact, they don't care about the law. We're going to see this again at Judas when he tries to return the money. Or they're going to say, well, we can't put these few little coins. You know, the temple treasury is like millions and millions of dollars. We can't put these few coins in the temple treasury because they're blood money. You're the people putting the innocent person to death, and you're worried about a few little coins going into the temple treasury when you're putting someone to death? It's just hypocrisy. They don't care about the law. They don't care about any of that. And we'll see that over and over and over again. They don't want to enter into Pilate's palace because the next day is the Sabbath. They don't want to be made unclean by going into this Gentile building. What hypocrisy. They're in the midst of killing an innocent man, but they don't want to be impure for the next day's Sabbath, the high Sabbath. It's just hypocrisy. They're going to go through. You're going to see this cycle over and over and over again. And so they go looking for these witnesses, but Matthew is completely clear that they are false witnesses. And actually, it's stated pretty bluntly. We won't turn there, but Mark 14:56, none of them could agree. And we'll see that as we go through here. Look at verse 59. So the chief priests and elders and all the council sought false witness against Jesus to put him to death. It's a foregone conclusion, but found none. Now look how he says this twice, but found none, no witnesses. And even the false witnesses couldn't agree on their false witnessing. So they couldn't find none that agreed. Yea, though many false witnesses came, yet found they none. Notice Matthew says that twice. They couldn't find any. So now they have this big crowd of people willing to be false witnesses. They rule out that one. They rule them out. They go through this list. They keep sending people away. No, that won't work. That won't work. That's such a bad false witness, we can't even pretend it's true. And now we're down to the final two. Verse 60, at the end of verse 60, at the last came two false witnesses. And this is what they said. And they said, this fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days. So there you have the best they can come up with. But notice they're introduced with the statement, they're false witnesses. Matthew makes that perfectly clear. And what makes this false? What makes this so Caiaphas isn't going to be able to use this? Well, lucky for us, we have what Jesus actually said. So let's go over to John 2. John 2, verse 19. This is at the beginning of Jesus' ministry. Remember, there were two cleansings at the temple of the temple. Jesus cleansed the temple once in the beginning of his ministry, and he cleansed it a second time at the end of his ministry. We read about the end one because that's in Matthew. The first one is here in John at the beginning of his ministry. And he cleanses the temple here. Now, this is a different cleansing than the one at the end of his ministry. Here, he's going to throw out the money changers and stop the sacrifices, but he's not going to stop all the activity in the temple. He doesn't shut down the temple in this one. When you get to the one at the end of his ministry, he does all the same things he does here, except then it says he shuts down, that he stops all movement in the temple. Now, of course, it was a temporary symbolic shutting down of the temple because it picked right up after he left. He shuts it down completely to demonstrate, we read back in Matthew, that he's all done with that temple. It's now not God's temple, it's their temple, and he leaves it. And it's shut down. Here in John, he doesn't completely shut it down at this point. And so let's pick it up here. We're not going to go through the whole account, but because we just want to see what did Jesus actually say at this time and compare it to what the false witnesses said in Matthew 26. So let's go to John 2. Oh, let's pick it up. Well, you know the story. Verse 15, we'll just scan through the first couple of verses. And when he had made a scourge of small cords, he drove them all out of the temple. Verse 16, and said unto them, sold doves, take these things hence. Make not my father's house a house of merchandise. And then verse 18, then the Jews, so now he does this, and the Jews have a question for him, and said unto him, what sign showest thou unto us, seeing that thou doest these things? And here's Jesus' answer. This is the this is what those false witnesses were taking and changing. This is what Jesus actually said. Verse 19, destroy. Now remember, this is in response to a question from the Jewish leadership here. They're asking him, well, why show us a sign? Why are you doing this? And he answers that question by saying, destroy this temple, and I will raise it again. I will raise it up in 3 days. So now keep your finger here, but flip back to our verse in Matthew 26, verse 61. And there he says what these false witnesses said is he said, I am able to destroy. And in Mark, he actually says, I will destroy. The false witnesses there say, I will. But is that what Jesus says in John 2? John 2, verse 19, he says, he's answering their question, and he says, destroy this temple, and I'll raise it again in 3 days. Do you see the difference there? Who is the subject of that sentence? He doesn't say, I will, or I am going to, or destroy this temple. Who does he say is going to destroy the temple? If the implied subject is you. It's you if you destroy this temple. He's answering the question from the Jews. He's not saying, I will do it. He's saying, if you destroy this temple, I'll raise it again in the third day, in 3 days. So it's a false testimony. He never said, I will destroy the temple and build it and raise it again in 3 days. He said, if the Jewish leaders do it, I will raise it again the third day. And of course, we take it a step further. What was the actual context? Look down at verse 21. The actual context isn't that brick and mortar temple with all its fancy gold and jewels and all that stuff in there. What he's really talking about, verse 21, but he spoke of the temple of his body. That's what he was talking about. He didn't say, I will destroy this rock and mortar temple and then rebuild the rock and mortar temple in 3 days. He was talking about his body. And if you destroy this temple, my body, which is what we see them doing here in Matthew 26 and 27 and 28, they're going to destroy his body. They're going to put him on that cross. If you destroy it, I will raise him again. And of course, he's going to rise from the dead in three days. And so it's false witnesses. Again, Mark, in Mark 14, he comes out and says they couldn't agree. Caiaphas couldn't even use this testimony. Even without any rules or regulations and being as loose as possible, it's just false testimony, false testimony, false testimony. So Caiaphas has to come up with another line of attack. If he can't do away with Jesus through the words of others, these false witnesses, maybe he can get Jesus to say something and entrap him that way. He can get entrapped in his own words. And watch how this unfolds now. So he's got these false witnesses. The high priest is getting probably pretty exasperated at this point because they're proven to be false. Verse 62, and the high priest arose and said unto him, answerest thou nothing? He wants Jesus to say something because maybe Jesus will say something he can use against him. And what does Jesus do? He says, answerest thou nothing? What is it which these witness against thee? But Jesus held his peace. And so now as we go through here, Jesus doesn't defend himself. He's in playing the role as if it's he's fulfilling the scriptures with regard to that suffering servant. Now let's go take a look at that. Isaiah 53, we could really read this whole chapter, but we won't. We're just heading down to verse 7 or so. But we can see some of the things. Let's just begin reading at verse 5. This is Isaiah 53, verse 5. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities, and the chastisement of our peace was upon him. And with his stripes we are healed. Here we have the salvation of Israel, Israel's national salvation package, and they are going to be saved through what this suffering servant does here. He's going to take, remember those courses of punishment? You could call them courses of chastisement. He's going to take all that chastisement onto himself. Remember the curses of the law? He's taking all those curses of the law, all that debt. Remember the parable, the 10,000 talents of debt, the trillions of dollars of debt to laid on the nation of Israel. That debt, that sin, those transgressions of the nation of Israel have to be removed before he can take that believing remnant and turn them into a free nation of his own. They got to get rid of that debt. And he's going to get rid of that debt, and then he's going to take that believing remnant, the many that he's talking about, this he's providing salvation for here, and he's going to make them into a debt-free nation through his work on this cross. Verse 6, all we like sheep. Here we have a picture of what's just happened in Matthew 26. All we like sheep have gone astray. What did we just see the disciples do at the end of the Garden of Gethsemane scene? They forsook Jesus and fled. What did we read just a few verses before that from the book of Zechariah in Matthew 26? Jesus quotes something from Zechariah. He says, the Lord of hosts is going to smite the Lord, the shepherd, and the sheep are going to scatter. And that's what we see at the end of that Garden of Gethsemane scene. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way. That is Peter's root problem. That's what the problem is. Jesus told him back in Matthew 16 when he tried to tell him about his death and resurrection. And Peter refused it and rebuked him. Not on my watch, Jesus. Not happening. And Jesus says what? Get thee behind me, Satan. He's trying to replace Jesus and God's plan with his own plan. Now, before you think, how could Peter do this and the disciples be so dull? That's what we do every second of every day. We are trying to get God to do what we want instead of us being involved in what God wants. So don't look down on the disciples here. This isn't something unusual. This is something we all do every hour, every minute, every second of every day. They try to replace, tell God what to do. This is the best way to go. God, do this and this and this and everything would be great. And God says, no, I'm doing this and this and this. And we don't like that. It's the same thing that the disciples are doing here. And so everyone has turned to his own way, and the Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. And here's a verse for our passage here in Matthew 26, he was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Remember in Matthew 26, Caiaphas, aren't you going to say anything? Aren't you going to answer? And he held his peace. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He is brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is dumb, so he openeth not his mouth. This is what, when it says the scriptures are being fulfilled and what Jesus is doing in Matthew 26, well, here's some of the scriptures. The scriptures of the Father. He was taken from prison. We can just read a few more verses and see all that's going on as we work our way to the cross. Verse 8, he was taken from prison and judgment, and who shall declare his generation, for he was cut off from the land of the living. Who's going to talk about his future generation? He's not going to, because he's cut off from the land of the living. He's put to death. But of course, there's a little surprise, isn't there, for Satan and his cohorts. For the transgression of my people, was he stricken. And he made his grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death. We're going to see all that as we get closer to the cross. Because he had done no violence, neither was there any deceit in his mouth. Unlike those false witnesses in chapter 26 who did have deceit in their mouth, and unlike because he had done no violence, he was a man of a humble. He surrendered to them. When Peter tried to, he said, put it down, Peter, and he put the guy's ear, which may have been the guy's, I'm sure Peter was aiming for the guy's whole head. But he probably ducked and only had his ear cut off, and Jesus puts the ear back. No, Peter. No. You're missing the whole thing here, Peter. Yet it pleased the Lord to bruise him. He hath put him to grief. When thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed. He shall, and here we get to the surprise. He's going to be put to death. Who shall see his generation? Well, he's going to see his generation. once he's made an offering of sin, he shall see his seed. Everything that results from that, he'll see that believing remnant restored to the nation of Israel. He shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. He shall see the travail of his soul and shall be satisfied. By his knowledge shall my righteous servant justify many, for he shall bear their iniquities. And we could keep going. Amazing passage. But hopefully you see all the little steps in there, and it's what he's going through right now as we're in Matthew 26. So let's go back to Matthew 26. So he's not defending himself. It's in accord with the suffering servant fulfilling the scriptures of Isaiah 53 on behalf of that Israel and the believing remnant. And so Caiaphas has to come up with another way of trying to get him to talk. So he's going to now adjure him before the living God. And now we'll see if Jesus opens his mouth now. Look at verse 63. And Jesus held his peace, and the high priest answered and said unto him, I adjure thee by the living God that thou tell us whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God. So now Caiaphas is going a little different angle. He's not asking Jesus to defend himself against these witnesses, false witnesses. He is asking him about his ministry and the work of the Father, the work of the living God. And now Jesus' mouth opens. And we'll see some of the things he says here. He's going to say some amazing things here. Caiaphas says, art thou, whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God. And what does Jesus say? Jesus, now he opens his mouth and he says, thou hast said. That means, yes, you're right. You said it. You got it right. I am the Christ, the Messiah of Israel, the Son of the living God. Remember someone else that said that not too long before? Matthew 16? Peter and his confession. Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus told him, no man taught you that, Peter. You've been taught of God. That's how Peter knew the Lord God was the Lord. The Father taught it to him. And so Jesus, Caiaphas says, are you the Christ, the Son of the living God? And Jesus says, you got it right. I'm the Christ, the Messiah of Israel, the Son of the living God. But now in our Matthew account, Jesus kicks it up a notch. Look what he says next. Nevertheless, I say unto you, hereafter shall ye see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. He's going to kick it up a whole nother notch. Caiaphas asked, are you the Christ, the Son of the living God? He says, yes, I'm the Christ, the Messiah of Israel, the Son of the living God. I am, and not only that, Caiaphas, I got another little information, a pack of information for you. When you see me again, I'm going to be the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power, and you're going to see me coming in the glory of the angelic armies, and I'm going to be bringing a kingdom from God the Father, and I'm bringing it down to earth, and I'm going to destroy all the kingdoms on earth, and I'm going to replace them with mine. How do you like that, Caiaphas? He's talking now about another passage that he's going to fulfill in the future. Go to Daniel 7. And we're not going to develop all these prophecies in detail with Daniel 7. But I just want you to see this is where he's coming from here as he's bringing these things up. Go to Daniel 7. Let's start at verse 13. This is where the scene is actually coming from. Daniel 7, verse 13. I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. And there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. You know what that means? That means they're not serving other kingdoms. His kingdom's going to replace theirs. It's going to be the kingdom of God on earth. It's been what we've been talking about in Matthew all along. The clouds of heaven and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. And there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. Does that sound like anything? The ending to another familiar covenant, like maybe the Davidic covenant? It's going to be an everlasting kingdom. And Jesus comes along. Here's Caiaphas. Are you the Christ, the Son of the living God? Yep, and that. And then he goes in and says, and not only that, Caiaphas, the next time you see me, I'm going to be the fulfiller of Daniel 7. You're going to see me. I'm going to get the kingdom from the Father. I'm going to be in the power and the glory, and I'm going to come down here. The next time you see me in power and glory with the angelic armies, and I'm going to replace, destroy the kingdoms of this earth and replace it with my kingdom, with the Father's kingdom. The kingdom of heaven will be on earth, just like that prayer that they were told to pray, thy will be done in heaven, on earth as it is in heaven. At that time, that will be fully complete. So he's going to do that. Look at verse 12. It kind of goes back to that, shows how he's going to do it. In verse 9, he says, I beheld till all the thrones were all cast down. He's going to destroy all the other kingdoms, all the other powers. Verse 12, as concerning the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet yet their lives were prolonged for a season. And then he gets this vision about the coming of the Son of Man. He's going to finish it all off. Now, you can imagine Caiaphas probably is a little startled by this because he doesn't believe any of this, of course. And let's go back to Caiaphas now. Go back to Matthew 26. So Jesus affirmed that he's the Christ, the Son of God, and added that he's also the Son of Man who would come in power and glory to establish his kingdom on earth. Now, before we see Caiaphas's response, we need to take a detail from another explanation of what happened here. So go over to Mark, and I just want you to see one other detail, and then we'll put it all together and see the remarkable thing Jesus is saying here. Go to Mark 14 and see what Mark says. Mark 14, verse 62. Mark 14, verse 62. It's the same account. Verse 57, they're still talking about these false witnesses. Verse 58, they say, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple. We've been through all that. Then Caiaphas asked him, verse 60, and the high priest stood before and asked Jesus, saying, answerest you nothing? What is it which these witness have against you? But he held his peace, verse 61, and answered nothing. So he asked him about the being the Christ, the Son of the, here it's the Son of the Blessed, the Son of the living God in Matthew. And Jesus said, now look at how Jesus actually, another way he responded to this question of Caiaphas. If we keep your finger in Mark, but if you go back to Caiaphas, how does he answer Caiaphas back in Matthew? He says, thou hast said. But how does Mark say he answered to make give some additional details about his answer? Look at verse 62, and Jesus said, I am. Now, hopefully, everyone listening after 26 chapters in Matthew and years in Israel's prophetic program, you all realize that when you hear the word, I am, you're talking about the Jehovah God of Israel. That's his name. I am. He gave it to them, the nation of Israel, just before the Exodus. He gave them this name. It's an incomplete thought. I am blank spot. You put in there whatever you need me to be. I will be your, I'll be your sacrifice. I'll be your life. I'll be your provider. I'll conquer all your enemies. I will do everything. You just put fill in the blank line. I'll do everything else. His I am, his Jehovah name. And now we get a little more detail. When Caiaphas says, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the living God?" He's saying, "Yes, thou hast said, I'm the Christ, the Son of the living God." And now he says, to complete that, "I am." Now, if that doesn't strike you, let's just think a little bit about what happened when he said, "I am," in the Garden of Gethsemane just a few minutes before this. Go over to John 18. John 18, we're backing up just a little to the Garden of Gethsemane, but look what happened when he said, "I am," in the Garden of Gethsemane. John 18, verse 6. This is when Judas is betraying him. They're coming looking for him. And he says, "I am he." And look at verse 6. "As soon as he had said unto them, 'I am.'" Notice if you have a King James, the "he" there is in italics. It doesn't belong there. Just cross that out. He's saying, "I am." And what happens? He says, "They went backward and fell to the ground." "I am." And they lifted off the ground. They were blown backwards and knocked over. Now, it doesn't say in our account, but if we go back now to Matthew 26, now we have three titles he's talking about here. Well, really, four. The Christ, the Messiah of Israel. He's the Son of the living God. He's the I Am, the Jehovah God of Israel, the creator of the universe, the creator of all things. And this, he's all those things, and he's coming back as the Son of Man in fulfillment of Daniel's prophecy to establish his kingdom on the earth. That's quite overkill for poor Caiaphas, I'm sure. Caiaphas, we're going to see his response. But when he gives him all that information, he wouldn't say a word when to defend himself. He's the sheep going to the lamb going to that cross. But when it comes to the Father and the living God and the God of glory and his plan and purpose through Israel, that is something he'll talk about. "I am the Christ, the Son of the living God. I am." Now, it's not in the account, so no one has to believe I say this. Maybe my imagination goes a little wild sometime. But I personally, when I read that in Mark, the "I am" comment, I see all these chief priests, the elders, the high priest, they're all standing there looking down on Jesus. And I don't know, when I just have this feeling when he said, "I am," that maybe it worked like the "I am" in the Garden of Gethsemane, and those chief priests and all that whole religious system got lifted in the air and were just blown back. Because you're going to see Caiaphas' response. He's going to be out of control. He's going to blow a gasket. So that's what I add to the text. No one has to go along with that. That's how I dramatize it a little. In the context of the Garden of Gethsemane, he said, "I am," and it blew them all back. Lifted them off the ground and threw them back, and they fell backwards. Here and before Caiaphas, he says, "Thou hast said, I am." And I just picture in my mind, they're all lifted off the ground and blown back. The Christ, the Messiah, the King of Israel. And when you see the Son of the living God, and not only that, I'm also the Son of Man, who's going to return in power and glory and destroy all the kingdoms on earth and replace it with my own. How do you like that for an answer? You wanted an answer, Caiaphas. Well, how about that answer? Now let's see Caiaphas' response. And of course, it's not very surprising at his response here. He's going to pretty much blow a gasket. Look at verse 65. "Then the high priest rent his clothes." We're back in Matthew 26, 65. "Then the high priest rent his clothes, saying, 'He hath spoken blasphemy. What further need have we of witnesses? Behold, now ye have heard his blasphemy. What think ye?' And they answered and said, 'He is guilty of death.'" Now I'm still bringing along this picture of them all being blown over backwards. So I see them picking themselves up, putting them on the chair. You don't have to go along with that. It's not in here. I just added that based on what happened in Garden of Gethsemane. But you get the idea. He's blown them over, whether literally, physically, like in the garden, or just mentally in this explanation of who he is. They think they have everything they need now. They say he's committed blasphemy because, of course, they don't believe who he is. So he's claiming to be God in many different ways and in many different senses. And they call it blasphemy. And now they've got what they need for him to go to issue him that death sentence. And that's exactly what they're going to do. And notice the high priest rent his clothes. Here's another example of the hypocrisy. They claim to be adherers to the law, do everything in the law. They're so loyal to the law. In Leviticus, I don't think I wrote down, Leviticus 21, I think, it says that the high priest was not to rip his clothing. That's what it was, specific command in the law that the high priest was never to rip and rent his clothing. And he rent so much for the law. It's just a charade. We've known this. That's why we, from the very beginning, it's just a vain religious system. It's just all hypocrisy. They're not interested in God or the law or any of that stuff. They're interested in their own power, maintaining their own positions, and carrying on their own things. All right. So now we get, so they got what they think they need. He's guilty of death. It was a foregone conclusion. They were going to figure out a way to do it anyhow. If we go back to verse 59, you'd see that. They're going to humiliate him. Then did they spit in his face, buffeted him. We read some of this in Isaiah 53. And others smote him with the palm of their hand, saying, prophesy unto us, thou Christ, who is it that smote thee. So obviously they start hitting him. He probably puts down his face and closes his eyes and he's getting hit. And they're like, well, now prophesy, which one of us hit you? Because, you know, his eyes were probably closed. And it's like, and now they're just going to mock him. And we're going to see that as it goes all the way through here, all the way to that cross. And now we're going to pick up Peter. So let's go to Peter now. That's where we're going to leave off Jesus, at Caiaphas. He's been given the death sentence now. They think they have the evidence they need, and whatever they need to go to Pilate. That's going to be the next step on this, a Roman governor, so they can get him on that cross, on the Roman cross. So now let's read about Peter. It's important, I think, to bring out here, Peter's problem is not that he was a coward. We just saw him in the garden trying to lops a Roman guard or a temple policeman's head off. He's not a coward. His problem is that he's replaced God's plan and word with his own. And that's the problem we all have. That's why we are defeated so much. That's why we despair so much. That if we embraced and believed and valued God and what he's doing, we may be sorrowful, but there'd be no despair. There'd be no defeat. We'd go and read the end of Romans 8. What can be defeat us? We're more than conquerors. It's just when we replace God's things with our own things. Defeat, despair. It's one thing to be sorrowful. It's another thing to despair and be defeated. That's Peter's problem. Peter's problem isn't he was a coward or wasn't manly enough. This guy is a fisherman, a man of a man type thing. He fought with the sword. His problem was that he was replacing God's plan with his own plan and everything was falling apart. Men's plans always fall apart. Apart from God, everything man does is vanity. And this is what Peter sees. Now, luckily, there's going to be this thing that happens after the cross, after the resurrection, and everything's going to change. And we're going to see a little picture of that and what happens right here. What's going to happen after the cross is he's going to demonstrate what happens here. So let's go through the rest of this account. Peter's just watching. Remember, if we go back to verse, just flip back a page and see where we left him off. He entered the courtyard, verse 58. But Peter followed from afar off unto the high priest's palace, and we know from other accounts that's into the courtyard there, and went and sat with the servants to see the end. He's just gone off to the side. He's waiting for the train wreck. He knows the train wreck's coming. He's just waiting for it. He's despairing. He's defeated. His whole world is crashed down. And now let's see what he does here. Verse 69. the verse 69. He's going to start denying, and there's going to be a progression that happens here. Verse 69. Now Peter sat without the palace. And other accounts explain it's in the courtyard of the palace. And a damsel came unto him, saying, "Thou also wast with Jesus of Galilee." And what does Peter say? But he denied before them all, saying, "I know not what thou sayest." So he starts out, he's going to start out by saying, "I don't know what you're talking about." Now let's just watch how this whole thing kind of catapults out of control here. Then verse 71, and when he was gone out into the porch, so he's going a little further away, right? He got into the courtyard. That became too hostile for him when a damsel, a young woman, asked him about if he's with Jesus. Then now he goes out to the steps that'll probably, I guess, lead into this porch. He goes out a little farther, and he says in verse 71, and when he was gone out into the porch, another maid saw him and said unto them that were there, "This fellow was also with Jesus of Nazareth." And again, he denied, and look how it escalates with an oath, "I do not know the man." Who's the man? Jesus just said who the man was up in verse 64. It's the Son of Man coming in glory and power. And he says, "I don't know this man." And notice he adds an oath. Now, hopefully, I know Matthew 5 seems like it's been ancient history and probably don't remember much, but there was a little thing about oaths back in Matthew 5. So let's go back to Matthew 5 and just refresh our memory. Remember in the end of Matthew 5 there, it had all these what I call little vignettes of what the people in the kingdom are going to look like. And it went through the whole, remember the thou shalt not be angry at your brother, that's committing murder in your heart, thou shalt not commit adultery, all those things. And he comes down through here, and now he comes to the one we're interested in for what Peter's doing. Look at verse 33. Matthew 5:33. Here we have another picture of the people who are in the kingdom. "Again, you have heard it hath been said by them of old, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths. But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor the earth, for it is a footstool, neither Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great King. Neither shalt thou swear by thy head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black. But let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay, for whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil." The kingdom, what Peter and the rest of that believing remnant should have learned at the very beginning of the gospel, this is the Sermon on the Mount, way back at the beginning, kingdom children won't use oaths. Why won't they use oaths? Because in the kingdom, what's true on the inside is going to be what they're saying on the outside. You won't need an oath to prove your veracity, because in the kingdom, what you say on the inside, what you think on the inside is going to be what you say on the outside. And he says here at the verse 37, any whatsoever is more than this comes from evil. Saying things that you think on the inside, but then changing them, lying about them on the outside. And that's what Peter's doing. He's not even supposed to be giving. As a kingdom child, he's supposed to not need an oath, because what's true on the inside should be what he says on the outside. But what's he doing in here? And denying Jesus, what's true on the inside, he changes and denies Christ. He doesn't acknowledge what's true on the inside. He lies and he adds an oath. You're not supposed to have oaths in the kingdom, children. What's true on the inside should be what comes out on the outside. And he gives an oath. And he goes and it intensifies. It went from, "I don't know what you're talking about," to, "I don't know the man." And we just read about the man a couple verses before this, the man of God, the man who is going to come in glory and power to set up his kingdom and replace all the other kingdoms of the earth. "I don't know this man." And he expresses and does it with an oath. And again, verse 73. And after a while came unto him they that stood by and said to Peter, surely thou also art one of them, for thy speech betrayeth thee. Well, evidently he had a Galilean accent. So every time he talked, other people were like, wait, that sounds like a Galilean accent. So now they come and they confront him. Are you from Galilee? Are you associated with Jesus? And now look what Simon, or what Peter does. Then began he to curse and to swear, saying, I know not the man. Now he goes to curse. What is Peter and the 11 and that believing remnant supposed to be to the world? A blessing. And now here you have Peter cursing and making oaths because he's lying. And he's denying not just what they're talking about, he's denying the man. He's hit his low. And we'll see what happens when he realizes it. Look at verse 75. And or the verse 74. Then began he to curse and to swear, saying, I know not the man. And immediately the cock crew. And Peter remembered the word of Jesus, which said unto him, before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice. And he went out. Now he leaves the courtyard. This is the end of our scene. He goes out now. He leaves. And wept bitterly. I think there's another passage we should look at. Luke 22. Luke 22, and we'll see the other side to this, because there's someone else looking down on him. Luke 22, verse 61. You have it. Excuse me. And you have the same scene, verse 61, and the Lord turned and looked upon Peter. So now you have Peter in the courtyard. He hears the cock crow, and he looks up, and Jesus is looking down at him. They make eye contact. And Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had said unto him, before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me three times. And Peter went out and wept bitterly. Peter has come to the end of himself. Would it be that we would all at one point come to the end of ourselves? If you haven't been broken by God's word, let it replace all your things with his things. You're going to end up in this same position. Peter is broken by God's word. What does he do? He remembers something. He remembers what Jesus just told him that he didn't want to remember. Flip back, go back to Matthew 26 and see what Jesus just told him before this whole account. Look at Matthew 26, verse 31. Then saith Jesus unto them, all ye shall be offended because of me this night. Look down at verse 34. Jesus said unto him, now it's Peter specifically, verily I say unto you that this night before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice. He said, during this night, you're going to be offended by me, you're going to deny me. And what did they say? Verse 35, and Peter said unto them, though I should die with thee, yet shall I not deny thee. Likewise, also all the disciples. Jesus just told them they were going to Christ. And I remember who Jesus is. He just told Caiaphas that Christ, the Son of the living God, the I Am, Jehovah God of Israel, the Son of Man coming in power. He just told him. He's going to deny him and offend him before the night's out. And they say, no, it's not going to happen. And now we see it happening. And it all comes, and it just floods back. What does he remember in verse 75? He says, and he remembered the word of Jesus. Finally, Peter remembered the words of Jesus, which said unto him, before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice. Finally, Peter comes to his senses. Finally, Peter realizes to go by what God says, not what he says. He's now totally broken. He goes out and weeps bitterly, but he's going to be built up again by God and His Word. And this is, in my way of thinking, this is a little picture of what's going to happen with that far bigger truth. See, this is just a little words of Jesus. Jesus said, before the night's out, you're going to deny me. It's kind of a little thing, okay? They rejected that. What was the big thing Jesus told them, especially beginning back in Matthew 16? He said, I have to go and suffer at the hands of the vain religious system. I got to be put on a Roman cross, and then I'm going to rise again on the third day. And Peter rebuked him. Not on my watch. Well, you know what's going to happen after the resurrection? Peter is going to come to his senses again. And he's going to remember all those things he said about his death and resurrection. This little picture here of the denial is a picture of the bigger thing Peter's been ruling out of his thinking. He's going to have this brought back to his mind after the resurrection. And what happened here is going to happen with that bigger truth out at that resurrection. All right. So that's where we're going to leave him now. He's been broken down, and it's not just broken down to be defeated. It's broken down because now, brought to the end of himself, he can be built up now in the word of the Lord, in Jesus' words, in the Father's plan. And so we'll just close with this final slide. You have here in closing these two faithful and unfaithful servants. As the suffering servant of Isaiah 53, who embraced the Father's word and plan, you have the three affirmations of Christ: Christ, the Son of God, the I am Jehovah God of Israel, and the Son of Man in fulfillment of Daniel's prophecy, and the reestablishing God's glory on the earth, as the disciple who rejected Jesus, his words, and the Father's plan, three denials of Christ. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know the man with an oath. And I don't know the man with oaths and swearing and cursing. And he goes out. He looks up. Jesus is looking on him. And he goes out and weeps bitterly. But Jesus has the solution to this. I can't leave it on this. I was going to stop here. We got to do one more. Go to John. And we have to close with this. John 20, the last verses of John. I don't know if I wrote that down. Last verses of John. Jesus is going to have the answer to these three denials. And there's going to be something better that comes out of these three denials. Now that Peter has reached the end of himself, realize all his plans are worthless, not worth the paper they're written on. God's plans are the only things that matter. Him being involved in Jesus' things isn't his way to get God to do what he wants. It's God's way to get him to do what he wants, what God wants. And look how Jesus is going to salvage this situation. Verse 15, John 21, 15. So when they had dined, this is after the resurrection. So when they have dined, Jesus saith unto Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me more than these? He saith unto him, yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. He saith unto him, feed my lambs. He saith unto him again, and the second time, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? And he said unto him, yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. He saith unto him, feed my sheep. Verse 17, he saith unto him a third time. He's offsetting those three denials with three proclamations of love. And he said unto him a third time, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? And Peter was grieved, because he said unto him the third time, lovest thou me? And he said unto him, Lord, thou knowest all things. Thou knowest that I love thee. And Jesus said, feed my sheep. He says in Matthew 26, if we went back there, we're not going to, just before Garden of Gethsemane, he said, strengthen my sheep. Here it's feed my sheep, same type of thing. He's going to offset the three denials with those three proclamations of love. Peter isn't a lost cause. He's going to come through this. He needed to be broken down. He needed to reach the end of himself so that he could rely solely on God. Would that happen to all of us? Let's close with a word of prayer.